Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Throughout this series, created in partnership with Coutts, I will be speaking to senior experts, thought leaders, and influencers from the worlds of travel, architecture, investment, consumer goods, and more, as we examine how we can embed purpose and sustainability into our everyday lives. From responsible investment to electric vehicles to eco-conservation, we will explore the new technology, partnerships, and initiatives helping us all to lead cleaner and greener lives. My guest today is Richard Curtis, writer, director, co-founder of Red Nose Day, and a UN Sustainable Development Goals advocate. As a film writer and director, Richard is responsible for such iconic British films as Four Weddings and a Funeral, Notting Hill, Bridget Jones' Diaries, Love Actually, and About Time. For his real job, Richard is co-founder and vice chair of Comic Relief, which he started after visiting Ethiopia during the 1985 famine. Red Nose Day, Comic Relief's signature fundraising event, has donated £1.3 billion to projects in the UK and internationally over the last 20 years. In 2015, Richard helped bring Red Nose Day to the United States, where it has raised nearly $150 million to help children in the USA and around the world. Richard is a founding member of Make Poverty History, helped to found Project Everyone, and is now a UN advocate for the Sustainable Development Goals. Richard is also co-founder of Make My Money Matter, a people-powered campaign fighting for a world where we all know where our money goes and where we can demand it is invested to build a better future. Welcome, Richard.
I'm exhausted listening to that.
So am I.
I'm surprised I got up this morning. and thank you very much for saying that that the movies and TV are just a side show, because that's certainly how my life is curving out now, I have to say.
Well, I think that to have led on that side of your ledger all these extraordinary things is just such an important testament to your life. So we're thrilled to have you and to be talking. And I want to get straight to the point on Make My Money Matter. Why on earth have you chosen to focus your latest campaign on pensions of all things?
Well, you know, you're surprised, I'm surprised. You know, in a funny way, Paul, my whole career in this has been about getting money to places that need it and where it can make the most difference. And, you know, with Red Nose Day, I felt that charity was the way to take the public's money, spend it on brilliant projects that were directly dealing with issues home and around the world. And then I suppose I moved towards the awareness that government had, you know, the bulk of the money. I remember Bob Geldof saying to me he made more money over a cup of tea with President Mitterrand than he did in the whole of Band Aid and Live Aid, because, you know, Mitterrand tweaked up the French aid budget by 0.1 or something, and that was billions, whereas Band Aid, Live Aid only raised like 100 million. And I think my sort of third very slow revelation is that the real money, you know, is in business and investment. If you're going to try and turn the billions into the trillions that the SDGs need, it's not going to come from tickling up aid. It's going to come from really getting business and finance to support the most positive industries. And, you know, so the aid budget is, I think, 14 billion. The UK pension pot's 3.1 trillion. And the moment I realized this and realized that I didn't even know that my pension was invested, as it were, I just leapt on this idea that it would be great at least to tell people that, you know, the biggest thing they could do, in fact, to make change was to check that their pensions were ethically and sustainably invested. And, you know, it's a tremendous, I think there's a bit of Nordic research that says, it's 27 times more effective to move your pension than it is to give up flying and to give up eating meat, as it were, every day of your life. So I got into it as an innocent, the situation that most people, I think, will be in. And every single step of the way, it's turned out to be a more and more effective way of executing change. But change that needs to be hugely accelerated, because people don't know, because the pension funds are slow in making these adaptations, and because, you know, even legal frameworks aren't right. So we just wanted to create a public wave to try and make ethical investment move fast.
So human beings are famously susceptible to inertia, and you know, getting people to kind of switch their pensions or think about their pensions in a proactive way through an ethical and responsible lens is an extraordinarily hard thing to do. So how are you using your storytelling skills from your other life to help change all that?
Well, one, by saying it's not extraordinarily difficult. You know, that is the truth of it. It's a bit difficult. It's not as difficult as giving up meat and giving up flying, as it were. And so, you know, as usual, I'm just trying to simplify things. In some way, I see myself on these issues as a marketing person, you know, so simply saying make my money matter tells you some of the message. One of our other slogans is have a pension you can be proud of. And that gives you a feeling. What, a pension, something that I could actually sort of relish in my life? Have a pension with intention. So it's partly about slogans. And then we're making little, you know, 1-2-3 minute things. We've got a lovely film made by a group called Quiet Room, which is just interviews with a bunch of people who get shown two clipboards, one of which says you could be investing, and you probably are investing in arms, gambling, pornography, fossil fuels, cigarettes. And then they're shown another bit of paper which says you could be investing in renewable housing, discovering vaccines, affordable housing, discovering vaccines, affordable healthcare, renewable energy. And so it's just making people alive to it. And then we're going to start increasingly saying to people, well, this is how you do it. And one of the key things is most people, to get their pension through their businesses, through the people they work for, ask the finance person in your company who does understand it, whose job it is to sort it out, where is our money? And they can do the difficult stuff. That's their job. They can say, well, let's change our default pension to something that's ethical or sustainable. So just trying to make it seem as unfrightening as it actually is.
And when you talk about kind of tangible actions that individuals can take when it comes to directing their finance, I mean, obviously one of them is just, you know, go to the people in your company who are responsible for the pension. But when you start thinking about your own pension, is it actually easy to discern how your pension is invested? Or do you think there's work to be done in trying to make their, you know, better disclosure standards or greater transparency?
It's getting easier is the answer, and we want to accelerate that. For instance, Mark Carney's working on a method now, which I think will be ready by the COP, of saying that every business should have a temperature attached to it. You're a 3.5 business, you're a 5-degree business, you're a 1.5-degree business. And that means that every pension portfolio will eventually have a temperature attached to it. So if you see that you're in a portfolio that is, you know, at 3.5, and at 3.5 degrees, insurance as a business will cease to exist, because insurance businesses won't be able to cover all the costs of all the things that may happen. So, you know, all the standards are being worked on. It's a question of creating public demand now in order to accelerate that progress. And then you'll get to a position like in Australia, there's a brilliant pension fund called My Future Super. They have superannuation funds there, you know, and their whole marketing device is to say everything is ethical and sustainable. So it's going to move faster if, you know, with each one of us who does it, with each one of us who says, by the way, if you can't sort this out, I'm actually going to have to move either to another fund in your pension schemes, or I'm going to have to move my pension provider. And that will mean that they want to be sure that they've got their system sorted. I mean, I really would say to people who are listening to this, do it tomorrow. I wrote a letter. I've written letters to a friend of mine who run big businesses, and they get straight back and say, oh, I'll do it. Yeah, what an interesting thing. And, you know, it's very popular with employees, very popular, because they suddenly see, I can literally sit at my desk as I did yesterday, but now in the knowledge that I'm supporting the best, most progressive, most diverse, most gender sensitive organizations, rather than just throwing my money into things I don't believe in.
So you've been doing this work for over 30 years, and I wonder where you see the target of your campaign. I mean, it seems to me that people who are in their 20s are almost by default think in ethical and sustainable and climate change terms. And people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s are becoming more aware, but require a little more education. Where's your campaign? Who are you targeting? I mean, obviously everybody, but where's the real work to be done?
Well, Paul, this is the big change, I think, of the last few years. I mean, I'm feeling it a bit because I've got, you know, young adult children. But I think that people now, young people, are asking, what can I actually do? Not who can I give my charity money to and who can I vote for, even though those things are still as important. But my kids are saying, what clothes do I wear? What foods do I eat? Where do I put my money? How do I travel? All of these issues. So I think, I wouldn't say they're a soft target, but they're leading people like me into campaigns like this. And I actually have written a little film, which we may make, which is about a dad saying to his daughter, darling, I need a serious discussion about money. Have you taken out a pension? And she says, well, I'll do it. And then a month later, she says, Dad, I need a serious discussion about money. Do you know whether or not your pension is ethical? So I think that it cuts both ways. I think that young people are going to be in the vanguard of this. But there, you know, there's no reason why people as old as you and me shouldn't also try and change the way we behave, the things we do, rather than just sort of think about it theoretically and in terms of, you know, charity.
So with Comic Relief and with Project Everyone, and indeed with so much of what you've done, you've worked with celebrities to draw attention to campaigns and to goals and to causes. And when has that been effective and leveraged, and when can that have its own dangers of sort of greenwashing or conscience appeasing, but not really leading to kind of substantive change? How you seem to have walked that line very successfully in your life, and how does one walk that line?
Yeah, I mean, that line is changing. There's absolutely no doubt that people are looking more to hearing from people on the ground. You know, there was that interesting Me Too moment, wasn't it, when all the women came to that award ceremony, but they brought an actual campaigner with them. And I do think it's slightly flipping, as it were. I think in the old days, you used to say, I'm going to support Angelina Jolie's campaign, whereas now Angelina Jolie says, I'm going to support Amika Georgia's campaign, someone you don't know, but who I think is on the rock face. So I do think that things are shifting. But, you know, celebrities are still extremely useful. I came into this because of Live Aid, which was, you know, pushed by pop stars who didn't know, apart from Bob and Bono, really very much about the details of what they were arguing about. But they used their music to bring it to the fore. Comic Relief has still done that. But as it were, you can see us shifting into allowing people who are working in the projects to explain the projects rather than, as it were, you know, David Tennant doing so. So I think that, you know, you can't get over the fact that at the same time as this shift is happening, celebrity culture is also still as powerful as it's ever been. And I think the thing is just not to put the celebrities in a position where they're pretending to know stuff they don't know, and to try and get them to encourage people to listen to the people who've got the best ideas and know from practical experience.
So I want to switch now to your work on the Sustainable Development Goals. And firstly, for those people who may not know what they are, can you just tell us, you know, in words of one syllable, what the Sustainable Development Goals are?
Well, they're a absolutely unique political moment. 2015, 193 countries agreed on a very detailed plan for the next 15 years. I think it's got like 169 targets. There are 17 goals, which would get us to the position where we made absolute, I mean, how Paul Polman of Unilever puts it is, be the last generation to have extreme poverty, the last generation to be threatened by climate change, and the most determined generation to end inequality and injustice. So they really are a plan. There's no other plan which is as comprehensive. They deal with everything from jobs to climate to hunger to health to gender equality. And particularly with regard to businesses, they're an amazing checklist. You know, they really are. In terms of governments, you want governments to be acting according to them. But so many businesses have, as it were, evaluated everything they do, their supply chains, their diversity, their gender pay, their way they use water, all of these things, in order to check out that they are doing and behaving in the right way and to give them, you know, aspirations and detailed methodologies of changing things. So they're a really useful guide for, particularly for governments and for businesses.
So how can you encourage ordinary people to align their spending power to support the SDGs? I mean, either via the brands or the goods they purchase or through their philanthropic donations, how do you make this incredible set of standards adopted globally through the UN more tangible and more real in people's lives?
Well, look, when it comes to charitable donations, the thing I love about the SDGs is they're a binder, as it were. You know, they bind people like myself who've campaigned around poverty and justice to people who are campaigning around climate. They point out how those things are completely interlocked at every single point. You know, if there's problems with the planet, there'll be problems for people on the planet, and the problems with the planet will hit the poor and women particularly first. I think business is a really interesting thing because, I mean, there are some great examples of businesses who are seriously, you know, aligning with these issues. Unilever have done it. Every single product, every single company they've got, they're really looking at everything in the light of the SDGs. I had a conversation with someone from, is it Reckitt Benckiser?
Yes.
Who was saying they're literally looking at each product. So they're looking at the tablets that go in washing machines and saying, are we helping save water by using this tablet? How can we, you know, adapt everything to a much more SDG consistent product? And I think that I would like businesses to be noisier. I think that the time for modesty is gone. We're in a real shift. We're moving from what they used to call CSR, corporate social responsibility, good, smaller projects that companies helped that were a form of philanthropy, into actually socially responsible corporations where they investigate every piece of their behavior. And I think that more and more companies are doing that. I wish that they, and I think many of them, are branding it with the SDGs. And I think people are getting a sense of that. You know, I mean, not only from buying my Tom's shoes, as it were, which I know are doing good, but you will increasingly get a sense of those companies that are working hard on it. I mean, I think it's going to be true of fossil fuel companies. Some are working hard because they are probably going to be the people who can introduce renewable energy with most money, and some are not. And I think it's good for the public to know who's trying and who's not trying. Drive past the bad petrol station and go to the better one.
Yeah, I spoke to somebody yesterday who said that the scale and speed of change in the world right now is a little bit like a forest fire ripping the way through the world, because the fossil fuel industry will collapse quicker than we think. The livestock industry will collapse quicker than we think as protein starts costing roughly the same as sugar. And when those industries collapse, and they collapse fast, then there will be regrowth in a forest in the way that it happens after a fire. And I think we're beginning to see the regrowth of an ecosystem that hopefully is is better, is kinder, is more sustainable.
And I don't know. I don't think that's like optimistic claptrap either. I went to a meeting at the Guildhall before COVID, and obviously COVID has changed the world. But very serious business people were talking about the sustainability agenda being the biggest business opportunity since the Industrial Revolution. The number of new businesses, the number of new behaviors that are coming up represent a genuine opportunity to move into a new phase. And I think one of the things about COVID, which is such a deep, you know, personal and global tragedy, is that you want to try to push hard to make it an opportunity for benign change, as they were the phrases, to build back better. I always use the example of the NHS. I mean, what an extraordinary thing to happen after the Second World War. Instead of retrenching, the UK took on a very expensive, idealistic, and brilliant concept of free healthcare for all citizens at a moment when they realized how precious all citizens had been in winning the war and fighting for all the things that we believe in. So I do think that COVID may accelerate change. And the danger is that it slows it down and that we go back to the old ways for 5 years to, as it were, sort ourselves out. But I think that everyone should be really looking whether or not this is the moment that they take the great leap forward rather than, sticking to the old ways.
So I suspect that you are by inclination an optimist, or else you wouldn't be doing the work that you've done for the time that you have. But we are talking at a moment that I think will, when we look back in the history books, will be 2020 will be written about in the way that we spoke about 1939 and the beginnings of the Great War and some other kind of epochal moments. On the balance sheet of where you see possibility and where you see peril, tell us where you stand.
Well, I'll talk about the possibilities. I mean, by the way, my optimism is obviously partial. You know, the reason why I've written so many optimistic films is because I've had such a lucky life. And I think that if you have done, it's a good thing to reflect your own experience of, you know, family and friends and all of those things which my films do. But, you know, Comic Relief has been consistently practical proof to me how generous people can be, how people are passionate, how they do engage, how many people are working on brilliant projects, the best of philanthropy in order to change things. And the SDGs has shown the number of businesses that are engaging in it. I mean, that's one of my major reasons for optimism. I remember the Secretary General saying to us advocates that the shock for him of the last few years has been the extent to which business has led on the goals rather than politics. So I do think that, you know, it's particularly in the way that businesses behave, it's particularly in the way that consumers are now going to want more information and change their behavior. It's in an impatient, almost aggressively impatient younger generation that will not, certainly in the West, tolerate racism and gender inequality and all of these things. So I think all of these are a good cause for, you know, a real cause for optimism. Now, we all know the political things that have been moving in the other direction, but let's see how the cards fall in the next few years.
So you worked on a range of huge campaigns, and we're also in the middle of unprecedented attention to climate, gender through Me Too, race through Black Lives Matter, and you've sort of seen campaigns come and go, campaigns that have fizzled, campaigns that have succeeded. As a sort of kind of a person who sat in the cultural zeitgeist for some time, tell us what you think makes for a successful campaign, something that sort of shifts perspective and genuinely changes paradigms, and you know, maybe just reflect on that from where you sit.
Well, I think one of the great mysteries is, you know, you don't know the effect of what you do. I've got this sort of feeling about Comic Relief that our sort of cultural and educational effect has probably been more important than the money that we've raised, you know, which I would never have believed. I'm just fighting all the time for to get more and more money. But you probably have got a generation in the UK who watched Comic Relief when they were young and who learnt that other people's lives were very hard, that there were solutions to some of those issues, and that they could be part of it. And it may be that that mindset is in fact more important than the actual money and the actual support of projects. So I think we're, you know, we're in a very long game here. You're always building on the shoulders of people who've done things before. And I always think, you know, it is two steps forward, one step backwards, but you've at least gone up, a step. So, you know, when I think about Black Lives Matter at the moment, I think back on all the pressure on race that has been happening for many, many years, and you still reap the benefits of all those former campaigns and all that experience. So, you know, I would say, you know, that it, I've made it my business to be part of campaigns that are publicly famous, you know, and that I think that changes the public mood. But immensely important also, you know, are the people on the ground who are developing things that people don't know about, as it were. You know, there's a great campaign that's been going on for ages called Housing First. And it's just this idea that in order to solve homelessness, put people who are homeless straight into a home. Don't make them go through endless tests as to whether or not they'll be able to, you know, survive in a home. Try them in the home, they'll probably leave. Try them again, they'll probably leave. And the third time, they never leave. So I think it's always a mixture between public campaigning and then people, you know, on the coalface who are actually doing the practical work of developing new methods of change, developing new systems, you know, like microfinance and everything like that. So the public campaigns need the real campaigns. You know, when we campaigned the Jubilee Debt campaign, there was a very successful public campaign, but it needed the incredibly hard work of the finance ministers to sort out how it could actually happen. Campaigns per se won't do the trick, but what they should do is, as it were, lubricate the hard work by people who are doing the real work.
So I want to ask you a final question about the relationship between culture and politics, because it seems that you are unusually well placed to answer this question. It's famously been said that culture is upstream from politics, that what happens in culture flows down and influences politics far more than we think. And if you think about it in relation to, for example, gay rights, sexual equality, the moment in which I felt confident that we were going to win was when major gay figures were on television as central and much beloved characters, when in Boy Scout conventions or in churches or in your next door neighbor, people began to know a gay neighbor, and they weren't some kind of demonic deviant, but they were wonderful parents and extraordinary members of the community. And that then flowed through into the Supreme Court, into legislatures, and into real change. And the shifts in culture predicted and predated the shifts in politics. And as somebody who has been a purveyor of the cultural industries, I wonder if you think that that's true, and therefore whether when we're doing our hard work in the social change movement, whether we should be focusing more attention on culture than on politics, or should be dedicating more focused attention and culture, not neglecting politics, obviously, but culture is just so important.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I'm very much in the both and area. You know, there's a great group. I'm not sure. I think they might be called DocSoc now. It used to be called BritDoc. And what they did was they would take documentaries about an issue and actually try to turn them into politically effective tools. So there was a documentary about sexual assault in the American Armed Forces. And they got into a position where it was shown at the Pentagon, where every new soldier has to watch that film, where the people in the film were prosecuted, as it were. So I've always been a bit impatient with just producing something and then not trying to make it work. So I would say that I think these things are incredibly important, but also the application of them is important. So, you know, I'm very interested. My friend Paul Greengrass's Stephen Lawrence film was repeated on TV the other day. It's being used as a tool to try and make people feel more passionate and actually push for legislative change. So I think that it's really important, you know, that because actually after the, you know, partly under the influence of my daughter, just in the last few weeks, you know, I've been, you know, reading Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, been watching I May Destroy You, been watching a documentary about Nina Simone, you know, trying to, you know, trying to catch up emotionally so I feel it in my bones. But then I think I should also look at practical things. So Comic Relief has just made a grant, a new grant to mainly organizations that are, you know, BAME-led, which are actually action on the ground. So I'm a great believer. Use it for fuel, for passion, for information. All of that's very important. But if you're then in a position to make changes with your new resolution, then do that too.
I promise this wasn't pre-scripted, but I'm actually on the board of Documentary Society, and I could not agree with you more about the role of documentaries in making change. And I've been watching Good Trouble about the now late Congressman John Lewis's extraordinary work. And I think these things are incredibly powerful forms of storytelling.
But I actually think, Paul, by the way, I think that we need that with fiction too. I actually think we need to, you know, the people who made 12 Years, Steve McQueen, when he made 12 Years a Slave, would have wanted that to be an educational tool. You know, he made it from passion, not for money. So, you know, when you're talking about modern day slavery, have kids in schools watch that. By the way, I think we should use as much popular culture as we can in schools. I do think schools feel as though they're absolutely primed now with a new generation of teachers to have more of what's made creatively to be packaged. You know, Steve McQueen is more relevant now than William Wordsworth.
That is a beautiful note to end. As a storyteller, as a campaigner, and as a person who represents the confluence between culture and politics and always positive change, we're incredibly grateful for your time. And anybody who is listening to this, look up Make My Money Matter. See how you can adjust your pension if it's in your own power to do so, or cajole somebody in your business who can very easily, with the press of a button, change pensions to more ethical outcomes. And Richard, for all that you've done, thank you so much.
Well, look, thank you. And, you know, I know that Coutts are part of this and they're taking this very seriously, and the Conduit's a brilliant way of spreading ideas that lead to action. So thanks for asking me.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on Coutts and their recommendations for a sustainable lifestyle, please visit coutts.com/conduitconversations. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com.